My name is Brian Paul. I'm a partner at Ice Miller and local president of the Federalist Society. On February 23, 2011, Attorney General Eric Holder sent a letter to the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives informing him that President Obama's Justice Department was abandoning its legal defense of Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, which defines marriage as a union of a man and a woman. According to Holder's letter, this definition is irrational and violates the equal protection component of the Fifth Amendment. In recent testimony before Congress, here is part of what Ed Whalen had to say about this. Ed is president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and he was a recent speaker to this chapter. The Obama administration's decision to abandon defense of DOMA reflects a sharp departure from the Department of Justice's longstanding practice of defending congressional enactments. The Obama administration's own explanation of that decision cannot be taken seriously. Rather, as its broader sabotage of DOMA litigation makes clear, the Obama administration has subordinated its legal duty to its desire to please a favored and powerful political constituency, and it is eager to obscure from the public its stealth campaign to induce the courts to invent a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. As a matter of principle, all House members, whether or not they support DOMA, should vigorously support the House of Representatives' efforts to defend DOMA in court. That's what Ed Whalen had to say, in part. To tell us whether Ed is right about all this, we have here today Greg Katsas, a partner with Jones Day. Between 2001 and 2009, Greg served in many senior positions in the U.S. Department of Justice, including Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Division and Acting Associate Attorney General. In these positions, he handled or supervised most of the government's leading civil appeals, including cases on such important topics as the detention of enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay and the constitutionality of federal statutes on subjects ranging from the Pledge of Allegiance to partial birth abortion. Greg is currently one of the main attorneys, on the recently successful challenge to Obamacare in the 11th Circuit, a case that not a few people believe will end up before a higher court sometime very soon. Please welcome Greg Katsas.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me. When I was in the Civil Division, one of the statutes that I was charged with defending was DOMA, and I worked on those cases from about 2003 until 2009. Let me start with a little bit of background on the statute, then I'll tell you about the cases that we handled and how we handled those cases and what arguments we made in defense of the statute during the Bush administration, and then I will contrast that with the conduct of the Obama administration, beginning with a, at best, half-hearted defense of DOMA, leading to their current decision to abandon the defense altogether, and conclude that Ed Whalen is absolutely right. So, 20 years ago, as recently as 20 years ago, marriage law was perfectly clear and simple on the questions presented here. Marriage meant opposite-sex marriage, a union between a man and a woman. That was true under state law. State law with respect to marriage has really two distinct functions. There's a licensing function, which is the question of who can get married to whom. For instance, people under a certain age can't get married. People can't get married to their relatives up to a whatever degree of relationship, and people can only marry those of the opposite sex. That was the uniform rule throughout the states, indeed throughout the world, until fairly recently. There's also a distinct question of benefits. Once you answer the question, who can marry whom, the next ensuing question is, what benefits flow from being married. And state law, of course, has the entire subject of family law devoted to that issue on things ranging from support obligations to inheritance and so on. Federal law had a similar pattern. Now, federal law doesn't have the licensing function. The federal government is not in the business of saying who can marry whom. But federal law, like state law, does allocate various benefits and burdens based on marriage. And it turns out there are over 1,000 different federal laws that one way or another key benefits or burdens to marital status. A couple of the big ones, federal spending programs, employee health benefits. If you work for the government, you can get insurance for your spouse. Federal immigration law affords all sorts of benefits to family members of citizens or lawful permanent residents and the like. Federal tax law, in some respects, advantages people who are married. In some other respects, disadvantages people who are married. And just a wide range of random other things throughout the U.S. Code, on down to something as pedestrian as whether or not two people filing together for individual bankruptcies can pay a joint or separate filing fee. All of those federal benefits, like state law, uniformly applied only to opposite-sex marriages. That was the rule, the uniform rule throughout American history until 1993, when the Hawaii Supreme Court, in a case called Bear versus Lewin, threw a fly in the ointment by at least suggesting, not explicitly holding, but having a strong suggestion that the Hawaii Constitution, as a matter of state law, might require the state of Hawaii to recognize same-sex marriages. That suggestion from Bear was ultimately overruled in Hawaii by a constitutional amendment. But before that happened, and while the Bear litigation was ongoing after that Hawaii Supreme Court decision, there was a lot of uncertainty injected into the system. And there was uncertainty at the federal level on two distinct kinds of questions. One is sort of a horizontal question of what happens from state to state. So if Hawaii, in fact, were forced by its judiciary to recognize same-sex marriages, what would be the consequence in other states? If a same-sex couple were married in Hawaii and moved to Indiana, would the full faith and credit clause of the U.S. Constitution or any other conflicts of law principles compel the state of Indiana, say, to recognize that marriage, even though it would not perform it under its own laws? That's one question. And the second question is sort of a vertical question about the relationship between state and federal law, which is what happens to all of those benefits provisions that I mentioned under state law that are keyed to marital status. On the one hand, there are a handful of those 1,000 or so benefit provisions in federal law that explicitly define what it means to be married as one man and one woman. And for provisions where federal law provides an express definition, obviously the federal law would trump the state law under the Supremacy Clause. That would be fine. But there are a lot of those federal provisions that address marriage are silent on the definition of what it means to be married. So you could easily imagine once a state went down the Hawaii path, there'd be sort of an interpretive question for those ambiguous federal statutes. Should the federal law look by analogy to other federal provisions that define marriage as only a union of one man and one woman, or should the federal law look to the state law and just incorporate whatever state law defines marriage as? So if you're getting a federal benefit in the state of Hawaii post-Bear, maybe those benefits do apply to same-sex couples on the theory that the state law recognizes that marriage and federal law generally takes state law as it finds it. those are kind of the two problems that to which DOMA responded. DOMA was enacted in 1996. There are two critical provisions responding to each of these two problems. Section 2 of DOMA responds to what I described as the horizontal problem. It expressly permits states not to recognize same-sex marriages in other states. It doesn't tell states whether or not they have to recognize same-sex marriages as a matter of their own law. It doesn't prohibit states from recognizing marriages performed elsewhere when people move. It simply leaves the decision to the states, to individual states, to reach their own judgment about this and prevents decisions, policy, or judicial or legal decisions in a state like Hawaii from being imported, say, into a state like Indiana that might choose a different course against the will of the people or the legislature or even the judges of Indiana. That's one provision in DOMA. The second provision in DOMA addresses this, what I call the vertical problem, how you interpret state federal law in the face of state law that now may be unclear, or some states may be one way, some states may be the other, on same-sex marriage. This provision of DOMA says for federal law purposes, any term that uses the word spouse or marriage is limited to the traditional definition, opposite-sex marriage. Doesn't tell the states, it doesn't restrict state authority with respect to state law or state programs in any way, shape, or form. It simply says for federal law purposes, marriage will be understood consistent with the traditional definition and consistent with the definition set forth in every federal statute that actually has an express definition. DOMA was, when enacted, a non-controversial and overwhelmingly popular statute. It was signed into law by then-President Bill Clinton. It passed the House and Senate by huge majorities, including a majority of Democrats as well as Republicans in both houses, 85-14 in the Senate, 342-67 in the House. And it was supported by senators such as now Vice President Biden, future Democratic majority leaders Daschle and Reid, seven of the eight current members of the Senate Judiciary Committee who were in Congress at the time voted for DOMA, including such Democrat stalwarts as Senators Leahy, Schumer, Durbin, and Cole, and various others. And given that sort of then broad-ranging consensus, there was relatively little controversy and relatively little litigation during the first, probably no litigation during the first 7 or so years of DOMA's existence. That all changed with two watershed decisions in 2003. The first, the Supreme Court's decision in Lawrence versus Texas, which struck down state criminal prohibitions on homosexual sodomy. That's the holding of Lawrence, and then the rhetoric of Lawrence has a lot of sort of open language, pretty overtly sympathetic to the gay rights movement. That's Lawrence, and then following up on Lawrence, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court's decision in Goodrich, in which a 4-3 majority of that court, for the first time in American history, recognized same-sex marriage, only under the state constitution and only after saying that the state constitution affords broader protection than the federal constitution. But nonetheless, the combined impact of Lawrence and Goodrich obviously raise questions that weren't present before. I was in the Justice Department at the time when Lawrence came down. We became concerned about its implication for federal statutes, and we started looking at what kinds of statutes might be put at risk, and we quickly came up with the two obvious ones. It turns out there are probably only two. One was the Don't Ask, Don't Tell statute restricting military service by homosexual individuals, and the other was DOMA. In the immediate aftermath of Lawrence, as we were starting to think through how we would defend these statutes and what the attacks on them might look like in the post-Lawrence world, it seemed like the leading gay rights groups still were somewhat reticent about going after DOMA. They did mount a major constitutional challenge to the Don't Ask, Don't Tell statute, a case called Cook versus Gates, which went up to the First Circuit. They had Wilmer handling it. They had all the leading gay rights groups were amicus in that case with coordinated filings of 10 or 15 amicus briefs against us. We eventually won Cook in the First Circuit and generated a precedent that's very relevant for some of the later tactical considerations on DOMA, beating back kind of a major organized effort of liberal and pro-gay rights groups. We didn't really see anything like that on the DOMA front. What we had were a small number of individual cases brought by individual plaintiffs with no apparent help from the national gay rights groups. We had basically three cases that came up this way in the Bush administration. The first was a case called Candu, which was a bankruptcy case about the joint filing fee. That was the first one post-DOMA, my first and only foray into bankruptcy court. Second one was a case called Smelt in California, which we prevailed in district court on the merits, and then that went up to the Ninth Circuit where we prevailed on standing grounds. And the third was a case called Wilson versus Aki out of Florida. We vigorously defended DOMA in all three cases. We won all three cases. And frankly, they didn't seem terribly difficult cases, at least to me, at the time. Let me give you an overview of what the arguments are, how we argued those cases, and why it's, in my judgment, the DOMA defense was so strong on the merits. So the first point you keep in mind on the merits of constitutional challenges to DOMA, not a lot of people know this, it's a pretty important fact, is the United States Supreme Court has actually already decided this issue. In 1971, there was a Minnesota Supreme Court decision called Baker, in which that court, addressing a state law marriage challenge to the traditional marriage statute under state law, Minnesota Supreme Court holds no fundamental right to same-sex marriage, which is kind of the buzzword for due process, heightened scrutiny under the Due Process Clause. No invidious discrimination in the traditional definition of marriage, which is sort of the equal protection theory of heightened scrutiny, rejecting that theory, and that DOMA, that the state Minnesota marriage statute survives rational basis review. The challengers in Baker took that case up to the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, re-raised all of those fundamental rights, suspect classification, rational basis arguments, and the U.S. Supreme Court dismissed that case for want of a substantial federal question. Now, dismissal for want of a substantial federal question is a judgment on the merits. It is entitled to the same precedential effect as a merits decision. Lower courts are not entitled to disregard it. Baker suggests that at least a generation ago, not only did the Supreme Court think the challenge to a traditional marriage regime was meritless, it thought it was so meritless that it warranted a summary affirmance without full plenary consideration on the merits. Our first argument in these cases in any lower court would be simply Baker's a binding precedent, and one can debate whether or not cases like Lawrence sort of undermine one way or another the theories behind behind Baker, but Lawrence, by its terms, explicitly does not decide the question that Baker does decide. Lawrence says we do not address the question whether states are entitled, whether states must constitutionally provide special recognition for homosexual status protections like marriage for homosexual people. So you have the earlier decision explicitly deciding these questions on the merits, the later decision arguably in tension but explicitly reserving. In those circumstances, law is crystal clear that the lower court is bound to follow the earlier holding rather than the general trend in the other direction of cases. So that's the first and, in my view, dispositive point. But even if you get past that point, you still need either a theory for heightened scrutiny or a theory why DOMA doesn't survive rational basis review. And none of those seem terribly plausible. With respect to heightened scrutiny, that under the Due Process Clause, that question turns on whether one thinks of same-sex marriage as a fundamental right. A major strand of substantive due process law is the idea that courts will only make up unenumerated fundamental rights if they are deeply rooted in the nation's history and tradition. And whatever one might think of same-sex marriage as a policy matter, there is no remotely colorable argument that it is deeply rooted in the nation's history and traditions. There were no states recognized same-sex marriages, as I said, until very recently. Even to this day, only 7 states recognize same-sex marriage. In at least four of those states, that was done not by democratic judgments about what's deeply rooted in the society, but by judicial fiat in courts interpreting state constitutions. There are 8 other states which recognize some form or another of domestic partnerships, which give some but not all of the benefits of marital status to same-sex couples. So even today, you only have 15 states going some or all in that direction, which leaves 35 states affording no recognition whatsoever, and 43 states not recognizing same-sex relations to the same degree as marriage. And while there may have been those 15 states moving in that direction, there are also 41 states that have enshrined the traditional definition of marriage in their state constitutions, including 14 states in 2004 alone as a direct response to Goodrich, the Massachusetts decision, precisely to make sure that that same sort of judicial overreaching would not happen in those 14 other states. So whether you look to history or modern trends or any measure, there's really no colorable argument that there's a deeply rooted tradition for gay marriage. And the Supreme Court's own cases, which recognize traditional marriage as a fundamental right, link that right to related rights and interests of procreation and raising children, and describe marriage as essential to the survival of the species, which sort of supports the traditional view that marriage is linked to procreation, which can only naturally happen through the union of opposite-sex couples. Equal protection is an alternative theory for heightened scrutiny that people use. One question is whether DOMA should get heightened scrutiny because it arguably classifies based on sexual orientation. That question was never seriously at issue in our cases because most courts of appeals have held that gays are not a suspect class for equal protection purposes. So classifying on the basis of homosexuality or sexual orientation triggers only rational basis review. There, to the extent one might argue that the Romer decision or the Lawrence decision from the Supreme Court undermine that, there are actually four courts of appeals that have held post-Romer, post-Lawrence, that that rule persists to this day. And in every case that we saw, every case we had was filed in circuits that had already ruled that homosexuality is not a suspect class, so that was a pretty easy one for us to swat back. There's an alternative heightened scrutiny argument that's made on the other side that statutes like DOMA amount to sex discrimination. I'm a man, I want to marry another man, I am barred from doing that because of the sex of the person I want to marry. If I wanted to marry a woman, I could. I can't marry a man, therefore that's sex discrimination. That seems pretty implausible as well. If you think of any of the normal theories for triggering heightened scrutiny based on sex, none of them seems to apply here. DOMA is facially neutral. On its face, it treats men and women exactly the same. DOMA does not reflect any purpose whatsoever to discriminate against men in favor of women or against women in favor of men. No one has even suggested to the contrary. Even if disparate impact amounted to a constitutional violation, which it doesn't, there's no hint that DOMA sort of disparately impacts the freedom or marital choices on the basis of sex. DOMA does not segregate the sexes, unlike the anti-miscegenation statute at issue in Loving, which segregated the races with respect to marriage. That's the precedent people cite for this point. Completely off point, it seems to me. And finally, DOMA doesn't rest on any sex stereotyping. So the case for sex discrimination seems likewise quite weak. And then, absent any colorable theory for heightened scrutiny through due process or equal protection, the last piece of the analysis is there some reason why traditional marriage statutes like DOMA fail rational basis review? We said obviously not. Why not? Well, what's a legitimate government interest to which DOMA is rationally related? Well, start with the interest in facilitating the ideal relationships for having and rearing children. It is biologically undeniable that only opposite sex unions can easily produce children. And it seems to me pretty self-evident, but at least a debatable point, that other things equal, the best arrangement for a child is to be raised by both of the child's biological parents, which by definition have to be one man and one woman. And all you need to accept to uphold DOMA under rational basis review is not that that seemingly self-evident proposition is right, but only that a legislature could rationally have thought that that seemingly self-evident proposition is right. And that seems to us clearly right on the merits and at a minimum defensible. The response on that argument is to say, well, some opposite sex couples don't have children, so therefore DOMA is arguably over-inclusive relative to its stated purpose. Or coming at it another direction, they say, well, many people other than biological parents, usually the argument is made in terms of many same-sex couples, are perfectly good at raising children, and therefore DOMA is arguably under-inclusive relative to its purposes. The short answer to that is that over-inclusion or under-inclusion are not sufficient ground for striking a statute under rational basis review. Legislatures are entitled to draw lines. The only thing that matters is that the line be rational in the abstract. And this line, favoring those relationships that can naturally produce children, is at least rational in the abstract. We won, as I said, all of our cases making those arguments. When we left office, no federal or state court had ever held that DOMA violates the federal constitution, and no federal or state court had ever held that any traditional state marriage law violates the federal constitution. So the Obama administration took office in January of 2009. Over the course of the next year or so, challenges to DOMA expanded. There are currently about 10 cases, 10 challenges pending, more than we ever faced. I think the advocates on the other side were probably emboldened by a couple of considerations. One is the gains that they seem to be making in the political process. DOMA is less universally popular today than it was when it was enacted. Another is the sense that Obama would be with them, and much easier to do it with an administration that's sympathetic than against an administration willing to vigorously defend a statute. And I'm guessing at this, but I think probably a third consideration was the success that pro-gay rights people were having in California challenging the California constitutional amendment enshrining traditional marriage. That case went before a judge very hostile to traditional marriage who put on a show trial, none of which should have happened under rational basis review. The case was handled by the former conservative icon Ted Olson, which gave the other side a lot of comfort, and the traction they were getting out of that case, I suspect, emboldened them to get more bullish about thinking that maybe they really should be pushing on the federal front as well. So they have about 10 cases. They're concentrated in three courts of appeals, or three district courts within three courts of appeals, the First Circuit, the Second Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit. The reason why cases are filed in the Second Circuit is that is one of the relatively few courts of appeals that has not yet explicitly addressed the question of what level of scrutiny is given to classifications based on sexual orientation. The cases in the First and the Ninth Circuit are filed there based on our results in the Don't Ask, Don't Tell cases. I mentioned Cook versus Gates in the First Circuit. We won that challenge to Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But in the course of ruling for us, the First Circuit held that the Lawrence decision mandates some form of heightened due process scrutiny for statutes that impinge on private homosexual conduct. They then found heightened scrutiny satisfied based on interests unique to the military, but that's a good precedent for the other side, at least with respect to the due process prong of the argument. And similarly, in the Ninth Circuit, we lost on a motion to dismiss a Don't Ask, Don't Tell case on the same ground. So there's bad due process law for the government in those courts, but good equal protection law in that the First and the Ninth are among the courts that have held classifications based on sexual orientation only get rational basis review. So they're gravitating towards those circuits for each of those reasons. Obama administration comes in, and basically they have two different approaches. The first one engaged in the first 2 years of the administration can fairly be described as a nominal defense of the statute. And the second one, beginning in February of this year, as was mentioned, is an official abandonment of any defense of the constitutionality of DOMA. I'll talk about the refusal to defend in a second, but actually I think the nominal defense approach that they started with was even more irresponsible. They filed briefs, at best going through the motions of defending the statute. They pulled punches. They undermined their own case in various ways. They added to the briefs such compelling advocacy in defense of DOMA as statements that the president wants it to be repealed, that DOMA is discriminatory. That's sort of a word you might not want to use in equal protection challenges to a statute. And that they explicitly said that they were only doing this because they felt legally compelled to defend a statute. That may be a true statement, but it's not exactly what you would expect in a piece of advocacy. And all of the statements like that seem to be pretty explicitly the administration egging on the courts to rule against them. Even worse than that was their refusal on the rational basis review point, their refusal to make the single best argument in defense of the statute, which is the one I sketched out, that DOMA is rationally related to an interest in fostering what one might think of as the ideal stable relationships for raising children, namely that of two biological parents. They explicitly abandoned any defense based on that interest. That was the interest that Congress asserted when it passed DOMA. That was the interest that we prevailed on in all of the post-Lawrence DOMA cases that we had. And that is the interest that's prevailed in every single one of the state and federal cases rejecting rational basis review challenges to DOMA or state equivalents. That's what they gave up. What they put in its place is this sort of flimsy, kind of half-hearted argument that the rational bases are, one is preserving the status quo and wanting to move cautiously in an area of social change. Now, why in the world would that make sense unless one might think that the social change might not be a good thing? Why might it not be a good thing? It might not be a good thing insofar as DOMA undermines traditional marriage and the values it serves. There's empirical evidence from Scandinavia that when those countries accepted accepted same-sex marriage, one thing that happened over time was the number of children born outside of wedlock skyrocketed. Now, I'm not making this point right now to sort of take a position one way or the other on the merits. I'm just making the point that, you know, the concern about not moving too quickly makes sense only if you think that it may turn out that the traditional approach is better than the novel one, and they explicitly abandon any underlying merits argument that the traditional approach may be better than the novel one. So then the kind of derivative interest in not moving too quickly sounds pretty hollow. And the other interest they asserted is one in consistency of federal law across states. You wouldn't want to have one kind of, you know, marriage be recognized in Hawaii or Massachusetts for federal law purposes, but not in Indiana or Texas, depending on variations in state law. It's probably a good enough argument for rational basis. In my judgment, it's not the most overwhelming argument one could make for this statute, and it's undermined by the fact that with respect to all other questions of marriage, like, you know, what's the age cutoff, what's the cutoff in terms of how close the relationship is, federal law does incorporate state law and therefore accept a degree of disuniformity. So the non-defense defense ended up having its foreseeable and, I hate to say it, but I think intended effect, which is inducing a district court in Massachusetts to become the first court ever to strike down DOMA on rational basis review. And that court made a lot of hay out of the non-defense defense. It gave short shrift to the traditional argument about optimal relations for having children, and it said, well, you know, why should I worry about this when the government itself has abandoned this argument and told us that it has no support? And the court had little difficulty shredding these kind of half-hearted alternative justifications. So we now have a case in the First Circuit in which DOMA has been held unconstitutional, and it is the burden on the defenders of the statute to get that judgment overturned. I think that performance is, frankly, somewhat shameful. If a private attorney behaved in an analogous way at a minimum, that attorney would be fired, and perhaps that attorney would be up on ethics charges. It is true that lawyering for the government is different. Government clients can't choose their lawyers by design. If you're a federal client, you have to take DOJ as your lawyer. There are all sorts of benefits in that arrangement, but it only works if the lawyers are playing it straight. And playing it straight in this case means vigorously defending your client, and where a federal statute is at issue, your client includes not only the executive branch, but also the Congress. And if they, once they concluded that they were unwilling to make the traditional, historic, winning arguments in defense of the statute, if that's the position they took, they should have gotten out of the way sooner and allowed the Congress to bring in someone who would continue to assert the defenses that we had. They then, after 2 years of non-defense defense, they changed course, in some sense came clean, with the Holder letter in February, in which they explicitly acknowledged their position. They announced that they would refuse to defend the statute. To their credit, they did so in a way that facilitated the House of Representatives securing alternative representation to make sure that the best arguments for the statute would be made. And in my view, that is much better. That is much better than being the lawyer and tanking the case. But one might still ask, is there any fair reason for DOJ to conclude that it couldn't defend the statute? The traditional rule that has prevailed in DOJ for at least 30 years, and certainly during the entirety of the second Bush administration when I was in the government, was that DOJ will defend all federal statutes with two limited exceptions, regardless of the policy judgments of the administration. The two limited exceptions are, one, if the statute reflects an encroachment by Congress on the executive branch, and there DOJ is sort of forced to choose between its role as an executive agency and an arm of the president and its role as lawyers for Congress, and has decided, if forced to choose, it will go, the Attorney General will go with the President to whom the Attorney General reports rather than with the Congress whom the Attorney General represents. That principle is obviously not implicated here. No one has suggested to the contrary. The second limited exception is if DOJ concludes that no reasonable argument can be asserted in defense of a federal statute. Does anyone really believe that no reasonable argument could be asserted in defense of this statute where literally dozens of challenges had been rejected, no challenge had ever been accepted? On the point about rational basis, the rational basis review standard is very deferential to the government. The duty to defend standard adds deference upon deference. So the question would be, could any reasonable DOJ conclude that it was reasonable to argue that any reasonable Congress could have thought that DOMA had a rational basis? It starts to just get, I don't know, to me, painfully obvious, but they didn't see it that way. So Holder's letter says, first thing he does is he tries to water down the concept of reasonable stand, whether any reasonable argument can be made, and he says that there may be professionally responsible arguments. He says there are professionally responsible arguments in defense of DOMA, but those may not be reasonable. And he says there are plausible arguments, his word, in defense of DOMA, but those may not be reasonable. So the reasonableness standard kind of doesn't pick up things that are plausible and professionally responsible. That is bizarre as a matter of plain English. It also just does not fairly describe the practice of prior DOJ. As I can tell you, we never refused to defend a federal statute. The only time we did was in cases where there was a Supreme Court precedent intervening, not on the statute in question, but whose reasoning was squarely controlling, with no argument at all on something like whether Congress could use its commerce power to abrogate state sovereign immunity. The intervening decision, the court says, yes, you have the second statute, not exactly the one the court struck down, but the legal question is identical. That was the only circumstance in which we ever refused to defend. His substantive justification, beyond trying to water down the duty to defend standard, is the filings in the Second Circuit. He says now the government, for the first time, is forced to address the question of what level of scrutiny classifications based on sexual orientation get in a court of appeals where the question is open, and we, DOJ, are not going to take the position that they get rational basis review. Is there any reasonable argument for defending rational basis review? Well, let's try a couple. One, every court of appeals to have addressed the question, 11 of the 13 U.S. courts of appeals, had uniformly held these classifications get rational basis review. Zero precedent the other way. Four courts of appeals post-Lawrence reaffirmed that traditional traditional rule. He said that those cases, a lot of those cases rest on Bowers versus Hardwick, which Lawrence had overruled. That's demonstrably false, not only because the four post-Lawrence cases address the issue after Bowers had been overruled, but you read the very cases that he cite, and they go beyond Bowers and address the question under Supreme Court heightened scrutiny jurisprudence, and ultimately he's forced to admit that, yes, they go beyond Bowers, but he just doesn't like the way they come out. Even once one gets past the circuit precedent, if one were to consider this as a matter of first principles, Supreme Court has only five times in its history gone for heightened scrutiny. Race, sex, alienage, illegitimacy, and nationalization only with respect to states. It hasn't done that in almost, it hasn't created a new suspect classification in almost 40 years. And in the same time, it has rejected arguments for extending heightened scrutiny to various other groups like the aged, the mentally retarded, the poor, and to classifications based on close family relationships. So one might think that anyone trying to create a new suspect classification is running decidedly uphill. That didn't seem to bother them. And even apart from that problem, when you look at the factors the Supreme Court has used, those are at best debatable. One factor is history of past discrimination. Well, clearly, yes, with respect to homosexuals, but clearly the discrimination is also receding over time. Another consideration is immutability. Is the trait immutable? That's at least a debatable proposition. The American Psychiatric Association has said there's no evidence of a biological support for homosexuality. I don't know if that's true or not, but it seems like that's at least enough to make a debatable question. And in the California case where this issue was litigated kind of on a factual record, the plaintiff's own experts said that most people who engage in same-sex conduct have their conduct and preferences substantially change over time. So that seems at least debatable. And the final consideration is political powerlessness. And this, to me, sort of seems like kind of the open and shut point for not using heightened scrutiny. The political gains made by the gay rights movement in the last 15 years or so were breathtaking. They managed to repeal the Don't Ask, Don't Tell statute. They managed to create federal hate crimes law key to sexual orientation for the first time. They've secured various executive orders affording various kinds of protection under federal law. Obama has appointed more openly gay people in 2 years than Bill Clinton did in 8. And I think perhaps no anecdote illustrates this point better than the behavior of King and Spalding in the course of the DOMA defense. King and Spalding, proud national law firm, retained by the House of Representatives to defend the constitutionality of DOMA. One would think that, right, they're not advocating for DOMA. They're not even themselves taking a position that DOMA is constitutional. They're just a lawyer representing a client. They were so afraid of the political clout of the gay rights movement that they were willing to drop an existing client and leave him in the lurch. And by the way, not just any existing client, the Speaker of the House of Representatives. And in the course of doing that, make themselves a national joke and lose their single most prominent and best lawyer in the process, the guy who had gotten the engagement to begin with. So the case for political powerlessness seems not that great and steadily weakening. Two other points about the Holder letter, neither here nor there, but I find them interesting. One is he was quite explicit that the decision not to defend DOMA was made by the President of the United States, who ordered DOJ to take this position. Now, I think that's perfectly fine as a matter of constitutional theory and principle. The Attorney General reports to the President. I have no problem with that. But hearken back to the Bush administration when it seemed like it was a national scandal every time there was even a whiff of presidential interest in anything pertaining to DOJ. I remember, at my confirmation hearing, it was at the time when Senator Whitehouse would have these poster boards of these shocking propositions that the Bush OLC had embraced, threatening to create a dictatorship and end democracy as we know it. Things like, the Attorney General reports to the President. I mean, he held entire hearings sort of premised on the outrageousness of the White House trying to influence legal judgments of DOJ. And here we have a direct statement that the President ordered DOJ. I mean, imagine if President Bush had ordered DOJ, had issued a memo saying, I direct you to take the position that Al-Qaeda terrorists held at Guantanamo Bay have no constitutional rights. And there would have been a firestorm. It just seems like this is the perfectly fine operation of the chain of command. Second odd point about the Holder memo is he says they will not defend DOMA in court, but they will enforce it in the real world. And that seems really odd for a couple of reasons. One would think that an administration has much greater kind of prosecutorial judgment / enforcement discretion not to enforce on policy grounds a statute that they might not like than they do to take legal positions that are driven by constitutional positions driven by their policy preferences. Seems a little bit backwards, and it puts federal officials, you're some line guy in INS figuring out whether the same-sex partner of the alien before you is entitled to such and such a benefit. Think of the position you're in. You are in a chain of command that reports to the President, who on the one hand has directed you to apply DOMA, and then on the other hand, when your decision gets challenged, he's going into court affirmatively arguing that what you did was unconstitutional. It seems like a very bizarre perversion of the duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. So in any event, the upshot of all of this is that the House was able to retain competent counsel. Paul Clement, my former DOJ colleague and friend, former Solicitor General who worked with me on a lot of these cases, he's a great lawyer. He started filing briefs in some of these cases. I'm happy to say that the briefs resurrect all of the arguments that we had been making in the civil division. So at least as the cases move through the court, DOMA will be ably defended. Last thing I'll say, just responding to a question that I got from someone here indirectly through an email, which is what to make of the federalism issues in the First Circuit case. So the two Massachusetts cases I mentioned where the administration managed to successfully sabotage the defense of DOMA and create adverse district court rulings, they're consolidated cases, and one of them is a traditional challenge by a private plaintiff who's not getting a marital benefit and suing to get it. The other is a somewhat more unusual challenge brought by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, arguing that DOMA impinges on its state prerogatives and therefore violates the 10th Amendment. And the question is put to me what I think of that argument. The short answer is not much. General Fisher is probably better suited than I am to answer this because he filed a very thorough and persuasive amicus brief in the First Circuit why that position makes no sense. But, I mean, in a nutshell, the answer is you generally don't have a 10th Amendment violation unless Congress is acting beyond its enumerated powers. The enumerated power at issue in the First Circuit case is the spending power. The limits on the spending power are determined by a four-part test in a case called South Dakota versus Dole. The only violation of the spending clause power that the district court found in striking down DOMA on 10th Amendment grounds was that DOMA transgressed an independent constitutional violation, constitutional prohibition, namely the Equal Protection Clause. So the argument that DOMA is not authorized by the federal spending power is entirely derivative of the prior arguments that we've been through about the Equal Protection Clause. On the district court's own reasoning, if there's no equal protection violation, there's no spending clause violation. And if there's no spending clause violation, there's no 10th Amendment problem. The only slight caveat to that is there's one class of cases where you can have a 10th Amendment violation without an enumerated powers problem. Those are the commandeering cases where Congress either forces a state legislature to enact a statute that the state doesn't want to enact, that's New York versus U.S., or forces state executive officials to administrate a federal program, that's Prince versus U.S. Neither of those is remotely at issue in DOMA, where the only thing the federal government is doing vis-a-vis the states is choosing not to spend federal money on particular kinds of programs and particular kinds of people. Massachusetts' argument is, well, we want to spend money to subsidize same-sex couples. You're not spending money, therefore we have to spend more. That's simply the federal government's choice about how to spend its own money. And there's not a shred of 10th Amendment case law that suggests that the federal government conducting its own business for federal law purposes somehow impairs core sovereign functions. And the admittedly unrestrained freedom of Massachusetts under DOMA to either support or not support same-sex relationships as they so choose. That's all I have to say. I hope there's some time for some questions.